This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And boy, do we have a special guest today. Yes, he's a New York Times bestselling author. His name is Wally Lamb, and he has a really great book out now called I'll Take You There. And it is out from HarperCollins. Hello.
Hey, David. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I never thought this would happen.
Made time for you, David.
This book is terrific. I'm sitting here enjoying it this morning, just thoroughly enjoying it. I mean,
thanks.
And it reads so smoothly. I mean, it's so smoothly written and so captivating. I mean, I'm reading about the anorexia right now, and with the Karen Carpenter thing and everything, I went through that really. I remember that period, and it's bringing back memories. So,
well, in the story. The protagonist, Felix, his sister, comes down with anorexia in the pre-Karen Carpenter days before, there was a very much public awareness of that. So, he and his family are, sort of baffled by why his sister is doing this to herself. And, so I kind of wanted to, explore what that was like when you feel so isolated with, an illness that's in the family.
You don't realize how hard it is. I mean, to make somebody eat when they don't want to eat, it's impossible.
Right.
I mean, it's just impossible.
Yeah.
And the more you try to make them eat, the more angry they get.
Yeah. I worked as a high school English teacher for about 25 years, and often enough that would one of my students would come down with this malady, and it was tough. It was tough dealing with them in a way that was going to be helpful.
This book is just so enjoyable. I mean, I'm just, it just really is, and it's such a great book to sit and read. I mean, I could spend all day reading it.
God bless you. Thank you.
it's a lot shorter than your other books. Was that intentional, or
this is actually an extension of Felix Funicello's life, which is first taken up in one of my short books called Wishing and Hoping.
Oh, okay.
And I sort of borrowed from that style and that brevity to tell this story. Although this one, this continuation, I'll Take You There, is it's darker. That other one was written, as a sort of a lighthearted romp with a Christmas theme. This goes a little deeper than that one.
Now, did Lois really exist?
Oh, she did, yeah.
Because it's funny because nobody's ever heard that name before. I've never heard it before.
Yeah, nor had I. What happened was that when Wishing and Hoping was released, they made a movie of it. And I grew up and still live in Connecticut. There was a premiere of the movie at an old theater there that has been beautifully refurbished. It's called the Guard Theater in New London, and while I was there, I learned from the managers that when it opened in 1926, it had been a vaudeville theater, but they also showed silent films, which back then they called picture plays. And so I went and I did a little research on the Guard, and I found that the first silent film, the first film of any kind that was shown, was a Lois Weber film called The Marriage Clause. And it sort of struck me as curious, a film, a director, a producer that was a woman. I didn't think that happened at all back then, and it certainly doesn't happen all that frequently now in 2016, that a woman would be in charge of the film. So I began to, figure out who she was, did a lot of research, and one door opened upon another. One of the other things that they told me at the Guard was that occasionally they have ghost sightings there that they believe are you know, the former actors who have since gone to the great beyond.
Really?
And so I took those two things together. I said, well, okay, maybe I'll make old Lois a ghost and you know, allow her to speak, and, you know, maybe people can rediscover who she was, because she was quite a gal back in the day. She was a mover and shaker in the early industry.
Did they tell you what particular ghosts people have seen? I'm curious.
Well, they're not identifiable, you know, by name or anything, but several people have seen the ghost of a little girl who is holding a balloon. And then there was one ghost that they said was wearing a military uniform, and he is seen in one corner of the mezzanine up on the second floor of this very fancy old theater.
Oh, interesting! And you became really, really famous after Oprah picked two of your books, correct? Two?
Yeah, that's right. One right after the other. The first, She's Come Undone, had been published in 1992. And then Oprah picked it. You know, there was no Oprah Book Club back then.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a lovely call from her back in 1992 saying that she had read the book, and it had nothing to do with the show. She just said that she was an avid reader, and when she read a book that she enjoyed, she'd like to track down the author just to say thanks. So it was this really sweet call. And then 5 years later, I had no, you know, fantasies or expectation that she would remember having read, you know, this book, but sure enough, she did. And in 1997, they had just started the book club, and so she selected She's Come Undone and really, you know, put me and my work on the map. And then the following year, 1998, much to my even greater shock and surprise, she picked my just published second novel, I Know This Much Is True. So she kind of set me rocketing into the stratosphere.
Now, which one had the baby on the cover? That was I Know This Much Is True, wasn't it? It's funny how you can remember the covers of some of these books.
Right, yeah, the two infants who are sort of entwined. And that story is about identical twin brothers, one of whom develops paranoid schizophrenia.
So when you were teaching when you decided to start writing, I mean, where did the idea to start writing start? I mean, had you always wanted to write?
No. Didn't really think about writing. You know, I think probably when I look back at my childhood, what had kind of helped me prepare to write is I have a very visual orientation, probably because I watched way too much TV when I was a kid. You know, I was fairly new back then. But also, I drew all the time. I didn't really, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't really like to read that much. I read and wrote for my school assignments, but that was it. But I drew all the time. And now when I look back at some of those old drawings that survive, you know, I realize that I was telling myself stories, you know, through the visual stuff. So I was 30 years old when I sat down. Our first son had just been born. We were up all night in the delivery room, and I came back to take a quick shower, and I was going to call the relatives. And while I was in the shower, this sort of, you know, I didn't think of it as a character, but a voice, you know, said a couple of lines in my head, and I wrote them down. And you know, later on that summer, when I had gotten pretty good at, you know, changing diapers and all that stuff, I saw that little thing that I had jotted down. I sat down and wrote my first short story, and that's what started me off.
Hey, you must really love it, because it shows in the writing. I mean, there's definitely a love of writing in this. When you read this book, you think this guy's got to love to write, because it's so beautifully written.
Well, on some days I love to write, and on the days when I get stuck or stymied, I don't love it so much. But ultimately, yeah, I feel very blessed that you know, I've been given the opportunity to do this for a living, and that people respond to it.
What do you do when you get stuck and you can't think of something? What usually gets you unstuck?
Lots of times, if I get away from the computer, you know, in the early days, I thought I was very cutting edge because I had an electric typewriter. eventually I sort of made the leap into word processing. And that, you know, that really works well for revision, you know, cutting and pasting and all that. But when I get stuck, I like to get away from the technology. I'll usually print out some, you know, whatever pages are I'm working on, and I'll go outside and maybe drive to, you know, a brook or a dam, or sometimes if I'm really stuck, I'll drive down to the ocean, which is about, from where I live, about maybe an hour away.
Oh, wow.
And there's something I really, something about the sound, I think, of moving water that sometimes, you know, helps the flow. So if I take those pages that I printed out and bring along a Bic pen, and just sort of, you know, meditate a little bit and listen to that water moving, sometimes that will, you know, give me the, you know, the aha moment, or the way to go, when, you know, I've been blocked.
You must love movies because you mentioned a lot of movies in this book. I'm still reeling from the Cesar Romero, Desi Arnaz kind of. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know. I found that somewhere in the research. Who knows about these old movies?
Oh my God! I was like, I must drop the book. I'm like, I'll let people experience it for
themselves. Ricky Ricardo, right?
I just can't imagine the two of them. I don't know, but it just whatever it was,
Who knows?
Who can? Why do we? What is it? Why does it matter? Somebody else's personal life. You know, whatever they go through and whatever they enjoy, let them enjoy it. That's what
I
say.
Right.
We certainly live in that kind of society today where anything goes. Doesn't mean we always have to feel good around it, but, you know, you live with what you have to live with, I guess.
Right.
Now, you have
three
sons. How old are your sons?
Let's see, 36, 32, and...
Oh, my God. You don't sound any more like 40. I mean, my God. You must have started when you were like three or something.
Well, this is after all radio. If it was video, you would go, oh, yeah, this guy's an old geezer.
Now, tell me about this Kathleen Turner thing. The Meta book, is it called? What is that?
Yeah, I'm really excited about the Meta book. Meta book is actually it's an enhanced reading experience. Electronically, you can download it from an Apple app, and it plays on iPads and iPhones. And what you get is the full text of the novel, but also there is an audio play where really fine actors perform the story for you. There's a lot of visuals. There are a couple of documentaries. One of the documentaries is a six-minute film about Lois Weber, that early director.
Very cool.
And it kind of, you know, catches you up to who she was and what she accomplished. And there's a little documentary about me and my life. And
so who does Kathleen Turner play?
She plays the ghost of Lois Weber.
Oh, really? How interesting.
Yeah. And she does such a perfect job. You know, she's got that sort of command and, you know, that throaty voice of hers. So
who does Frances?
Frances is done by a wonderful recording, a narrator for audio. Her name is Tavia Gilbert, and, she's an award-winning, actress for voice.
I guess they're very careful about what voices they pick. I mean, Kathleen Turner's got this really strong voice. I mean,
yeah.
And she's such a great actress in her day. I think she's still
really
doing
is.
Broadway now, isn't she?
She is, yes. And I believe she's doing a little bit of directing too.
Now,
I've seen her in a couple of stage things. So yeah, she's very active in live theater, and she also does film.
Were you actually there when they were making the Meta book?
I was not. I was invited, but I had another gig to do that day, a couple of days. I guess she was in the studio. So I am going to meet her at the book party that they're going to have here in New York in a couple weeks. But I have yet to make.
Oh,
her
very cool. So you're going to be in Philadelphia next week, right? And right an
yeah,
hour from it.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Yeah.
At the Free Library. That's always a fun. That's a fun venue.
Yeah, I've just been catching up to that, learning a little bit about some of the great writers that get invited there. So I feel really, really privileged.
Do you consider yourself a great writer?
No, I consider myself a yeoman writer. You know, and that's true of me as a person too. You know, I'm very much, somebody who is an imperfect person working, you know, pretty hard to become a better person. And I'm also a working writer, you know, trying to be the best writer that I can be. So, but no, I'm sometimes sometimes when I'm giving a reading in front of a group, it makes me uncomfortable if people are reading along in their copy of the book because I'm still fixing it. So sometimes, you know, if I change what's on the print in front of me, you know, people will look up from the book that they're reading, you know, with that look on their face like, what? Yeah, but, you know, it's all still imperfect for me.
That's great. It's very humble of you. But I mean, like I said, the book.
I got a lot to be humble about.
Now, the book goes on sale today, I should tell people, November 22nd. That's today that we're recording this. And right, it's a Thanksgiving book, so you'll get lots of Christmas sales. Good for the Good Friday. The Good Friday sales will pick up for you. That'll be really terrific.
Yeah, well, that's all strategy from the book company. I'm just happy that they're going to send me out to meet people, and happy that the book is, they feel worthy of they feel the book is worth the push that they're giving it.
Now, I'm curious about the one long book you wrote. I know this much is true. That's a pretty long book, right? About six or seven hundred pages. Is it?
I think it comes in at 900.
900. What? How difficult was that to write? I'm curious.
It sort of lived in the hard drive of my computer for a number of years. I think it took me about 6 years to write that book. And one day, like maybe year number four or so, I said, you know, I better print this out and see what it looks like. And that computer printer started smoking almost, you know, and I had no idea it was going to be that many pages. I'm like, uh-oh.
Do you really get lost in the book when you're writing it? I mean, just lost in the fun of writing it?
Yeah, very much so. So that I'm, you know, my head is in the story, not what's going to happen, you know, after the story is done. And, of course, I'm talking about the umpteenth draft of the story, not the first draft by any means.
I'm so invested in Francis. I just got to see what's going to happen to Francis. I'm just like, I'm totally enthralled with this book. I think I'll be up the rest of the night reading it.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a great compliment. Yeah, she was a minor character in Wishing and Hoping, and Francis was played in the film version by the daughter of Kevin Bacon and Kira.
Oh,
Sedgwick.
yeah, okay. Yeah, I can't think of her name.
And she's a great job.
Do they when they make a movie of your book? Do the actors approach you to ask you about it or anything? Do they ever talk to you?
I certainly had a lot of interaction with them on the set of Wishing and Hoping.
Very cool.
Molly Ringwald is in it, and Conchetta Farrell, who played Berta, the housekeeper on
Two and a Half Men.
Yeah. And Meatloaf plays a drunken Monsignor in the novel or in the film. So yeah, I had a great time, and particularly I had a lot of fun with the child actors because this is about a bunch of fifth graders, and they were fun. They were good to I would take them on field trips when on their days off and so forth. So we had a great time.
That's wonderful. Yeah, all those memories. You know, life is full of memories. What would we do without memories?
I don't know. I got plenty of pictures to bring me back there, to that summer that we were on set.
Now, in anything that happens in I'll Take You There, is it anything based on your actual childhood? Are there any little stories?
Well, let's see. There are. I do have two older sisters, as Felix does, and I think he's about maybe 4 years younger than I am, but we certainly grew up in the same era, and I was able to sort of borrow on some of those, some of that nostalgia and the pop culture of the the late 50s, early 60s, that kind of thing. We share that in common.
Were your sisters anything like Frances and Simone in the book?
They are sort of exaggerations of their types. I did not have a sister who suffered from anorexia nervosa. So that was sort of borrowed from, other people that I've known later in life. But we grew up in working class Connecticut. I fictionalize a town in Connecticut on the eastern side called Three Rivers, Connecticut. It's based on my hometown of Norwich with a little bit of New London, Connecticut, mixed in there. And what people who are not familiar with the area don't realize that when you say Connecticut, we're very, very different than the western part of the state that is very New York influenced and, more fashionable. We're more feisty than fashionable. I like to say we're more liverwurst than pate over on eastern Connecticut.
Exactly. Oh, I had a cousin who was anorexic, so I know a little bit of what it's like. Even though I was an outsider and people would say, well, she's okay, and her sisters would be like, leave her alone, she's okay. And she obviously wasn't okay. But, it's so hard because then you approach them and you suddenly become the enemy.
Sure.
You're the one that's the bad guy, and that's hard. That's very difficult.
David, I grew up in a town that housed the largest facility for the mentally ill in our state. And so, I was always sort of fascinated and a little bit scared by, that hospital when it was a huge campus. There were lots of different buildings and so forth. And whenever we would drive by there, I'd be in the back seat of my parents' station wagon, and, I was always kind of fascinated with it and also, as I said, scared by it. And so then I grow up and, I become an adult and I start writing fiction, and I find that one of the subjects that I'm fascinated with is mental illness and its effects on, family life. So I go back to that quite a bit, and I don't know, maybe in another life I would become a psychologist or something, but that's a lure that I like to investigate in my work.
Well, I want people to know my cousin's just fine. She's happy. She's got kids, and she's living down near, I think, Baltimore somewhere, and she's perfectly happy, so don't worry about her. I'm certainly worried about Francis at this point.
Well, you're just going to have to keep reading.
Exactly. And I don't even know how it ends, so I can't give anything away, which is a wonderful thing.
You just seem, no spoiler for me, that's for sure.
You're so good with the visual stuff. I mean, I was talking to another author yesterday, actually, about visually picturing things. Are you good at visual things? Obviously, you said you like to draw, so you're very visual.
Yeah. And I think my interest in the movies kind of helps me out too. When I'm sort of writing down a scene, particularly in the first draft, I know that I'm having a good writing day or a good writing hour or so if I can see the scene in my head almost like a movie. And so it's part of it is visual, part of it is oral, A-U-R-A-L, so that I can imagine hearing the dialogue, and I love writing dialogue, and that's one of the things that comes easiest about writing for me. And so if I can both see it and hear it as if I'm watching a movie that's going on in my head, then that makes for a really satisfying writing session.
Now, who sang the song I'll Take You There? Was it the Staple Singers?
It was indeed, yeah. I'm a total music head, David. I have way too many CDs in my collection. I download music all the time. I have it playing when I'm writing. I jack up the volume.
Well, what kind of music do you like to play? I love 70s stuff. I could play 70s all the time.
I have one of these memories where it's a little scary, actually. I mean, I remember all those old lyrics. I could, I could sing the whole thing, God forbid, of I'll Take You There or any Motown song or any of the 70s classic rock stuff. But I like a lot of contemporary stuff too. I have, my sons sort of keep me abreast of, some of the cool stuff that's around now.
Well, I'll have to get you to sing a song next time I interview you. I think my audience would love to hear that.
All right, we'll do it.
I think I would love to hear it, too. I mean, don't we all love to hear music? I mean, there's something about music that just makes us feel so good.
I do a lot of singing in the shower, too. My go-to song when I'm singing in the shower is the old Aaron Neville song, Tell It Like It Is. I can really belt that out, particularly if there's nobody else in the house.
And but one thing I don't understand is loud music. Why loud music is so appealing to people? I don't like. I mean, I do not blast my car radio, but I don't understand. My brother does it, and he just turns it up at the most ridiculously high volumes. And I think to myself, how can that be pleasant? But yeah, I don't understand. I don't get that.
it also has an effect after a while too. I know I have a friend who's been into rock music, a lot of metal stuff and everything for years, and he's about the same age as I am, and his hearing has really been compromised.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, what Felix goes, he goes through a lot of his childhood. Would you like to do that yourself? I mean, can you imagine yourself doing that?
Go back and visit my childhood?
Yeah, like he's doing in the book.
I'm not sure. I think it would be probably, he finds it's very bittersweet because, like all of us, I think our childhood memories are both sometimes very sweet and sometimes, very
embarrassing.
Yeah. Oh, totally embarrassing. Yeah. But I, I was able to sort of do that by writing Felix and giving him that ability. I work. I've been running a writing program for incarcerated women for about 17, 18 years now, and very often, prison is a sad place, of course, and nobody sets out to go there.
Are these dangerous women?
They've committed some, very serious felonies. I have probably, out of 15 students, I think maybe 10 of them have, committed homicides.
Wow.
And, but when I give them the opportunity to write, and we're going to react to their writing, they can choose any genre they want, but most of them, like to write, pieces about their life. They go back to their childhoods, and I feel very fortunate in that I had a pretty good, not traumatic childhood, but they've really given me an education. The women that I work with about, how humbling it is for some kids.
Were you scared of them at first, or are you to the point now where you're used to them and trust them pretty well?
Yeah, no, I was never scared of them, but what makes me uncomfortable is the institution itself. The fact that you stand at the front gate and they buzz a door. Some big brother person behind a glass panel that you can't see into buzzes you in. And then one day I counted there are 10 locked doors that. Between the outside of the prison and the classroom where I teach the women, but the women themselves have they dispelled all of my stereotypes that I walked in there with that first day. I thought I was going in there for one day, and that was back in 1999, I think.
Wow.
And they challenged me at the end. Probably the most intimidating looking woman in the who had come to the class, she said, "Hey, thank you for coming." And I said, "Oh, you're welcome." And she said, "Are you coming back?" And so maybe there was a little fear at that point. I didn't know what else to say, so I said, "Oh, okay."
I'll be back. Yeah, right.
I'll come back in 2 weeks. I said, and if we can have a workshop. Give me 2 pages of anything you want to write about, and we'll do that. And by that second class, they had me hooked because they it's not that they were all great writers or anything, but they were so hungry to learn. And we've actually published two professionally published books of their writing, which I edited for them. And so they have become published writers too.
Now, are you working on anything right now?
Well, I've sort of taken I started a new novel, but I'm not sure if I'm going to continue with it. And it's so busy now with promoting I'll Take You There that it's kind of, I'm kind of letting it sit and wait for me. Mm-hmm. So, I definitely will start a new novel. And also, I'm involved in a couple of film projects with the earlier work. So, that'll take some time as well.
Wow. So you're not sure whether you'll finish the one you're working on. That's interesting.
Yeah, I've got a first chapter, and I've got an idea, a sort of a forward thrust to it, but I'm not fully committed to it yet, so we'll see.
Well, that's terrific. I know we have to let you go because you have lots of commitments today, and I think you're at the bookstore today, actually, somewhere.
Yeah, I'm over in Brooklyn, New York, at Book Court. I was there a couple of times before, and that's always a good time. So that's a good place to start the book tour.
This has been a pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to speaking to you again when you have another book out. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm going to go back and read. I'll take you there. I'm going to finish it today. So
sounds good to me, David.
And the book again is called I'll Take You There. It's out from Harper and all your bookstores. And you can get it on Amazon and all over the place. Thank you very much. This has been David's
all
book
right,
talk.
All right, David.
And we'll talk
have
to you next time.
Too.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Mm-hmm.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, Baldacci.